The power of empires to enforce new temporal grids as part of territorial conquest is central to the history of colonialism and techno-capitalist forms of social control. The imposing world of clocks, trains, telegraphs, cybernetic systems, fiber optic cables, with the dictates of their ticks and talks, nanoseconds in real time, is well documented. Cybernetic systems give way to AI and algorithms and robots. Whatever anxieties they inflict, they are still lauded as new time-saving devices. But these grand narratives of tech and tempo do an injustice to the multitudes of people that live, labor, and love under the confines of global capitalism and this enduring, cozy catastrophe that Mauritians just located. Machine logics don't just replace the social. The social remains an active site of creative and resistant negotiation. Just ask those for whom the technical present is mostly a time spent surviving and getting by. So why is it so difficult to understand across the field that there's no such universal experience of time or uniform effect of technology on social and political life? I suspect it is much easier for the tech bros of Silicon Valley and flash boys of high finance to continue on with the colonial project if we would all here in this room just submit to the notion that there is such a thing as a discrete technological age and its singular tempo. So where are we now? Apparently in the digital age under the duress of speed, where some insist we should just run with acceleration and never turn back. This totalizing gaze into the coordination of time-space is not only fictive, but completely self-serving to the powers that be. So without a doubt, technologies do introduce new temporal and spatial parameters of political and social possibility, but that is all they are, possibilities. If technology is to be harnessed for a counter-project like these feminist futurities Mauritian proposes, then a more nuanced and politicized conception of time is required. So time offer for the next few minutes is not so much a technological measurement of the real, but a structuring relationship of power, an intersectional type of difference, structured in specific political, economic, and geographical contexts. So I turn to the margins of time in the so-called technical present, and I have for you three low-tech stories that outline the otherwise invisible creative negotiations and attempts of counter-coordinating space and time within the technosphere. I can't get this on. Is she fixing it? There it is. And I turn to the margins of time in the so-called technical present against this backdrop of up here of their iconic image of Shibuya, one of the fastest intersections in the world. My first story, transit, the infrastructure of communication. A friend and I were waiting for a southbound train during a weekday morning commute at St. Clair Station in Toronto when the announcer informed riders that the line was experiencing a 20-minute delay. People expressed their frustration with eye rolls and exasperated groans, but just as quickly as the disrupted service was announced, a series of Plan Bs went into effect across the subway platform. Some were going to wait it out and took to leaning against the walls, and a few people hurried out of the exits informing others, "I guess I'm going to walk." As I contemplated my own Plan B, my friend had already jumped into action. After a quick scan of the crowd, she honed in on a young man in a pressed dark suit walking with a quick step while staring down at his phone. He did so with such practiced agility that she knew exactly where he was headed. He was going to the financial district. She also knew that he was Ubering rather than calling a cab because of the way he was maneuvering the screen with his thumb and index finger, holding his phone up to look at the screen under the dim light of the subway station. But she was in a rush herself and didn't have the 20 minutes to wait for a train. Waiting at the hospital for her was her new baby, born 12 weeks premature, in need of the express breast milk she had in her transportable cooler bag hanging from her shoulder. She sped up, going beside the smartly dressed young man, and started to walk in step. "You getting an Uber? Going south? Past Wellesley? I'm going to the hospital. Can I come with you?" He happily agreed, but he also never lost his pacing, never stopped walking or typing until the brief moment that they stood together at the corner of St. Clair and Yonge when their Uber pulled up. My dear friend was in survival mode, trying to keep her early baby alive and well. She had an acute awareness of what she needed to do in any given moment, activating the necessary survival skills that come along with being responsible for the life of another. But what is most remarkable about this scene is that she knew exactly where this young man was headed and how he was going to get there. He had all the signifiers of the iconic and privileged protagonist of fast living in a culture of speed. He had the suit, the quick step, was tapping madly away at his phone. He was plugged in and on the go, using network time to navigate the space of flows so he could bypass the public transportation system that had been grounded to a temporary halt. He was in charge of his mobility and his time, but also the time and mobility of others. While my friend was employing strategies to maintain control over time, she bore none of the recognizable accoutrements of good time management. When she hitched a ride on this young man's Vector, she was immensely fatigued, with tired eyes and a still protruding but empty belly, her arms full of bags stocked with the time-sensitive materials for the reproduction of the social order. Now enter the driver. The Uber driver, his labors entirely oriented around navigating the rhythm of the streets while maintaining the time demands of his fares. The drivers speed up, slow down, or made to wait depending on the tempo and time demands of whoever gets into the back seat. The Uber driver is pulled into driving by the promise that this labor means they are now in control of their time. But tell me then why they control their water intake so they don't have to risk having a parking ticket or a tow truck in order to urinate. Why they feel guilty when not driving, why they sleep during the day and work at night so much so that the sunlight soon starts to feel oppressive. These three figures are what I refer to as temporalities at the corner of Yonge and St. Clair, are just one example of the interdependent and relational nature of time. Temporalities are not randomly scattered, but intricately tied and inexorably shaped by one another. And too often, they are recalibrating to forms of power they are otherwise aiming to resist. Story number two, finance capital. Mid-April of 2012, occupiers across DC and New York City took to the sidewalks to sleep immediately outside of the banks and firms in their respective financial districts. Nearly every account of this sidewalk sleepover captured a similar rhythm. It went something like this. 5:30 a.m., the occupiers are fast asleep, the wheels of coffee carts rattle over the pavement, the smell of coffee fills the air. The night cleaning crews and security guards have left the buildings. Workers are hosing down the sidewalk across the street from the federal buildings. By 6 p.m., the protesters are waking up. You can hear the reverse beeps of the delivery trucks. These are quickly replaced by the sounds of traffic jams. Workers in suits appear and high heels begin hitting the pavement. Click, 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 click. Protesters hand out pamphlets. Some accept and leaf through them while the others look past the occupiers and head straight into the building. Between 12 and 2, another rush of suits and heels spreads through Wall Street. Cabs are hailed, subways are caught, lunch is ingested. At the end of the working day, the suits exit their steel towers. At this point, done with work at the office, some would actually stop and talk with the occupiers. These moments of intersection became popular pictures in the news media, celebrated as small victories for those that believe in the political possibilities of spatial pluralism. As night falls, the crab horns grow more distant and the crowds are gone again. Tucked away in the middle of the night at Wall Street, the rustling sound of sleeping bags, guitar chords, and the flick of cigarette lighters fills the otherwise dead air. Soon it will be 5:30 in the morning again. But what is remarkable about this scene is that the normalizing temporality of financial capitalist culture dominated the sleepful protest. Sleeping in public seems resistant because it troubles the spatial order, but it does not necessarily trouble the temporal order. The baristas, cab drivers, subway workers, dry cleaners, sidewalk cleaners, security guards, and night cleaning crews, so much cleaning, are all part of the architecture of time maintenance for the finance capitalists. Sidewalks are clean so bankers' shoes will shine, cab drivers get them to work on time, coffee is made to provide energy for the start of the workday. In some sense, what we have here in these instances of the sleepful protest is that everyone is properly in time and space in order to maintain the temporal requirements of the 1%. The sleepful protest is a potential resistant line of flight, but the sleepful protest had recalibrated to the 9-to-5, the ultimate temporal frontier that corresponds to an ideological notion of when someone is supposed to be at work, asleep, or at leisure. Its hold upon our political imaginaries is astounding. Occupied recalibrated to the power it aimed to resist. The time of the 1% remained untouched, unscathed. What was needed at this moment was a temporal insurgency, one that would have had as its target the temporal order of things. Story three, from the ultimate information machine, the library, morning at the Vancouver Public Library. The downtown branch of the Vancouver Public Library opens weekdays at 10 a.m. Every morning, the scene is the same. At 9:30 a.m., a mass of people begins to swell and gather outside the library doors. By 9:45, there is a crowd of 50. By 9:58, there are 100. The security guards open the door at 9:59, but no one enters. Instead, people wait. The people in the front row roll back and forth on their heels, staring up at the clock and waiting for it to strike 10. I witness this scene nearly every weekday morning for a month, and it takes little time to figure out who these determined library patrons are. They are a small contingent of Vancouver's homeless, mostly men, and instead of book bags and laptops, they carry sleeping bags, thermoses, and coolers. The security guard nods his head at 10. A surge of movement fills a quiet space, and the group rushes in. They disperse throughout the library. None of them speak to each other. They have their own routines. After an hour or so, the library is full of people writing, reading, surfing, but also sleeping. Turns out the city's homeless have come to the library to sleep, but they do so under the guise of other activities because sleeping in the library is not allowed. On the second floor, where the public terminals are located, one man looks busy surfing, his hand on the mouse as he sits at the computer. His impeccable posture makes him hard to miss, yet he is fast asleep. The top floor of the library is carrels that overlook the city. And here, too, you will find men fast asleep, but at first glance, you would never know. They all look as if they are so busy at work. For almost the entire month of June 1st, too, I am seated up on this floor. I get to know the patterns of my neighbors. A Japanese-Canadian man in his 60s arrives every single morning with an overwhelmingly large stack of newspapers and flyers. He spreads them out to cover the entire surface of his carrel. He takes off his shoes and places them off to the mat. He puts on his slippers, spreads his newspapers out as if they were his own tatami mat. He has a thermos and a cup of tea off to the side against the window. From a certain angle, it looks like he is busily scouring the city's newspapers. But the carrel is his ryokan, his place to sleep. A few carrels down, another man with another variation on this theme. He, too, looks buried deep in his books, cramming for his law exam, a stack of LSAT exam guides piled so high that he's able to remain quite hidden. His stack so large that it blocks the light coming through the windows, switching day into night. The security guards walk around the perimeter of the library and through the stacks. The guards know the sleepers, and they know what they're doing. But if these tired souls appear to be spending their library time wisely, they will not be asked to leave. As the security guards secure the space, they also secure a temporal order. The library's progressive stance on the city's homeless, then, is actually ultimately only spatial. They provide space so long as one stays correctly in time. So these are just three small moments in three small corners, but they reveal that the coordinating and standardization of time across culture is not experienced for most populations as a grand imposition. Minutes can feel radically different across the larger temporal differential. So the standard example that's often used of an observatory keeping the time of ships as they move at different speeds, at different distances scattered across the ocean, gives way to perhaps a more commonplace that we might recognize in our own urban fabrics. A business traveler makes an Uber appear by remote control. A young man working for Foodora cycles through rush hour traffic to deliver a single meal to someone burning the candle at both ends. A 5 a.m. cleaning crew made up of immigrant women attends to the morning after at nightclub. This is the temporal differential of the technical present. It unfolds with devices that communicate with one another while reorchestrating labor. The gendered, race, and class composition of who labors, how and for whom and under what conditions persists, much the same within the new technological infrastructure. So there is no singular tempo, but a complex rhythm of social differences manifesting in time practices and temporal expectations. Instead, what is shared across these examples is the expectation that one must recalibrate. Recalibration accounts for the multiple ways in which individuals and social groups synchronize their body clocks, their sense of the future or the present to an exterior relation, be it another person, pace, technology, traditional chronometer, institution, or ideology. The question is, shouldn't we be able to choose some of our chronometers? Temporal regimes and strategic dispositions are cultivated in order to simply survive within the normalizing temporal dictates of everyday life, but this remains largely invisible. So what now? with all of us here three together in a similar sort of discussion about uncoordinated time and space, we must continue to excavate and archive asymmetrical temporalities and their synchronic relations. Can we imagine new timekeepers and an even more expansive set of chronometers?